All right. So if we look a little bit more, so I always just use the traditional word so that way you can follow along, right? Action, which I don't particularly care for, but just trying to figure out how to do our Dharma work here. And of course, we'll take a quick look at the precepts. I think those are pretty good because that's typically when you look at the teachings on right action or you hear a Dharma talk on it, basically what you get is a teaching or a kind of a lecture on the five precepts, which is, to refrain from causing harm, to refrain from taking things that aren't freely offered to us, to be honest in our speech, which is interesting that just it's just the right speech again, so that we can almost put that one aside because we've already went over that. And then the other one, the last two, I think are interesting. I want to just pause on those for a little bit because I think they're the presentation that we generally get is not entirely accurate. So typically, the fourth precept that we talk about is being careful with our sexuality. Which is, pretty obvious what that means, or should be obvious what that means. But it's actually not sexuality that the teaching is, it's sensuality. It's about sense craving and sense greed and sense hatred. It's around, it's really a mindfulness practice of restraining our senses, what we see, what we eat, what we hear, the whole sensory apparatus. Is to be careful about the kind of things that we take in. So it's about guarding, and they're really mind. I think these are mindfulness practices. I think if I were to reframe in a really kind of a secular sense, the Eightfold Path is they're really just eight mindfulness practices. Be mindful of your views. Be mindful of your intentions. Be mindful of your words. Be mindful of what you do. They're just mindfulness practices, really what they are. Whether you're doing them right or wrong, it's really, again, not a great barometer or not a great measuring stick. So when we start to think about sensuality, we can look at our relationship to sensing experience or sensed pleasure. Now, this goes both ways. Sometimes we actually have a destructive relationship to our sensuality because maybe we don't feel like we deserve certain things. We don't enjoy, we don't allow ourselves to participate in the enjoyment of the sensory world through watching movies or eating food or all of the different hedonic, was the word I would use, hedonic sense pleasure. Sometimes we have destructive underdoings. It's not always overdoing. We can have destructive underdoings sexuality in our sexuality as well. It also includes, we want to be harmless, but we also don't want to harm ourselves, which a lot of times we can end up doing quite easily. And there's lots of ways we do that. So I think sexuality is important, but sensuality is really a broader perspective. Again, to be aware, to be mindful of how we are engaging in our sensory worlds. There's one thing that I can put a personal example in here that I've noticed that was kind of been interesting for me, and it actually comes from the Thich Nhat Hanh teachings on mindfulness and sensory restraint and precepts really, and that if I most of my adult life and certainly my teenage life I used to enjoy watching sort of violent movies. Your Tarantino, Pulp Fictions, Reservoir Dogs, crime thrillers. I've always liked those kind of movies. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but I don't know if it's also because I have small children in my house. I can't watch that shit anymore. I don't like it. I don't enjoy it. Me and my wife realized this about a year and a half ago when we were like, we have small kids, so when the kids go to bed, it's like, let's go upstairs and have some ice cream and watch a rated R movie. Like, I watched Toy Story 4 times today. Like, I want to watch an adult movie, right? And we started watching, I forget the name, it was some show on Netflix, some series that everybody was excited about. And we got like halfway through the first episode and it was so creepy and violent, we like had to switch it off. I was like, I don't want this shit in my mind. And I was really sort of surprised or curious about like, wow, I wonder where and how this came about. But and also I think a really perfectly example of that is how much news do you watch? I don't really, we don't have traditional TV where we live. We have, the streaming apparatuses, which is nice because there's not a lot of news. But I was visiting, we were out of town recently, and the people we were staying with had traditional cable and they would watch the news every morning. And I had coffee, morning coffee with somebody early in the morning, and I watched about an hour of the news. And I was like, I fucking do not want to watch that anymore. It was terrible, man. And I was like, I don't need this in my mind. You know, it was all, first of all, it was all bad. You know, of course, the news is always all bad. So I really had to kind of take a look at that. And so I think that as a mindfulness practice, we have to be aware of, and not to create some, you know, moralistic finger wagging either. That's not, the Buddha's not ever doing that. Thou shall not watch terrible news. If you want to watch the news, right? But be aware of how it impacts you, right? And then, you know, the other, the last one, which I could say a lot about, but I won't because it's controversial, is the precept or the work, Dharma practice around intoxications, drugs, alcohol, intentionally using substances that cloud the mind. Now, I have a bias. I'll tell you, I have a bias because I'm in recovery. And I don't drink, I don't do drugs, I don't participate in recreational drugs. I haven't in 20 years, and I don't suspect I will anytime soon. And I believe that the tradition, the Buddhist teachings are to actually not participate in that stuff at all. The insight world in our culture has opted to take a kind of more liberal view around, like, you know, it's okay to drink a little bit or smoke a little bit of weed, or now everybody's tripping out on ayahuasca now, which I think is crazy. They've opted for a more liberal view, which I think is, I push back against that. I think that that's a misrepresentation of the teaching. Now, also I will say, if you're going to do that, if you're going to drink and smoke weed and do that stuff, I don't have an opinion about that, but don't try to explain it in a way that, don't try to make it okay. Don't try to make it adherence to a principle, which it clearly isn't. Like, I'll give you an example. For example, I don't believe I truly practice the first precept because I'm not a vegetarian. I eat meat. I have chickens outside. I have prairie dogs on my land that I kill because they're very dangerous to my animals and my children. And I'm not going to put my children and my dog at risk for some prairie dogs. So I also have a lot of mice out here in the country, which I actually kill lots of animals every year and on purpose. And, you know, I also feel like, you know, this black and white thinking isn't so good either. So I don't feel comfortable telling students or people that I don't really totally practice the first precept. And I wish that people who drank and smoked weed and did these recreational drugs would hold that same thing rather than trying to justify it. Because clearly, I don't know what your mind is like. My mind is deluded and confused enough. I do not need chemicals in my system altering my perception any more than it already is. And so I think that, you know, that part of it is like, you know, is looking at our work. Now, some people, I know plenty of Dharma teacher friends who drink wine or drink a little bit, or they even smoke weed once in a while. I don't actually have any problem with that, because maybe part of their work that isn't getting in the way of their work. Maybe that's even enhancing their work, right? So I think this is also something that we have to respect our subjective reality. And understanding that, so then the question becomes, well, is having the glass of wine really helping you with your work, or are you using it in a medicative way? Right? Is it quote unquote taking the edge off? And it's like, well, why do you need to use an external substance to take the edge off? Why aren't you not able to take that on as a practice? And I think when we start looking at, and also too, when we look at, action or our work or our labor or our endeavor, I think that we also have to realize that a lot of that might be even a therapeutic kind of work, whether we're in recovery, traditional psychotherapy, talking to people about our past and the different things that we have all been through, as actually part of our transformative work. And it also might even include things like, maybe there's things that you do that you love that you don't get paid for. Our work doesn't, and I'll talk about this more next week, but I want to kind of give you a sense of what I mean. It's like, I'm a musician. I love music. It's part of my work. It's part of, it's been important to me. I don't get a dime from it, and I don't suspect I ever will. In fact, I probably spent more money on it than I've made from it. But just because it's not for money doesn't mean it's not part of our work. Now, I would probably argue that everybody on the screen, there's something that you do that's meaningful to you, whether you're an artist, you draw, you paint, you do pottery, you play music. I'm sure you all have certain things that you, and we call these hobbies in our culture, which I think is kind of derogatory almost. There are things that we do that are meaningful to us, that we feel connected to ourselves in a way. We feel whatever you feel around that. That also is part of our work. And what happens a lot of times, and this has happened to me before, I'm like, well, I can't play music, or I can't do my work because I'm too busy trying to survive. And then what happens is we start to realize, we start, you know, the paint canvases start to pile up in the garage, or the guitar gets a little bit dusty, or whatever it is for you. And then we start to kind of feel bad that we're not doing the things that used to be meaningful to us. It could be something like hiking or riding a bike or being in nature. It doesn't matter what it is. It's something that you do that's enjoyable for you. That's part of your work as a human. It helps you flourish. It helps you be well. It makes you feel more connected to your experience. It's a beautiful behavior. It's an engagement with part of the world that brings you happiness and joy. And it's really your job to make sure that you do that. Now, again, traditional monasticism, they don't do that. They're not allowed to listen to music. They're not allowed to do creative endeavors. Some of the Zen traditions do a little more of it. But classic monastic life doesn't. Actually, they say that that's a distraction. And for them, maybe it is. But for us, it's something that we have to come to terms with. And so this is why, and I have to go here because I think I will talk about it more next week, but it's so relevant to the conversation, is that right livelihood is the next path factor. Sama ajivaka. Ajivaka just literally means for life, what you do for life. And that is for survival. What you do to keep food on the table, what you do to make sure that there's a roof over your head, what you do to make sure that the car functions. And this is, I think, interestingly enough, what I've noticed in the last 25 years, this is the teaching that you see the littlest about. I don't think there's one Dharma book I've searched. Of the thousands and thousands of Dharma books out there, I have yet to find a book on the teachings of right livelihood. And I'll tell you what, it's the most complicated, difficult part of my life. And when I look to my Dharma path and my Dharma teachings for help, I don't get any. Basically, it says, don't sell weapons, you know, don't deal in prostitutions, don't sell drugs. There's like four things it says not to do, and that's all you get. It's essentially sort of useless, because the implication is, of course, the true right livelihood would be to be a monk, would be to join the monastery. And so you don't have to deal with any of this stuff here at the monastery. But the thing about it that's so interesting is the reason why I think that there's a secular and there's another Dharma path here, is if that were the case, if the right livelihood was to just join the monastery, then it wouldn't need to be a path factor. It would be irrelevant. It would be redundant. There'd be no reason to put it in there, would there? So obviously the Buddha, in his brilliance and setting up his teachings, maybe saw this maybe as something that could happen. And he made sure that he said, how you survive is part of your Dharma practice. And we live in a very destructive world in this sense. It's hard to find quote unquote right livelihood in this world. You know, the whole capitalistic economic system in which we all are dependent on, whether we like it or not, is pretty, you know, poorly set up. And I have to contribute, and I have to participate in something that I philosophically and ethically don't agree with, but I don't have the luxury of not participating. So it puts us in this kind of weird ethical dilemma. So it's very important. It's been very important for me that I actually separate my work and then what I do for money. Now, fortunately for me, or unfortunately for me, I've been able to blend the two. Because I'm a Dharma teacher, and I'm actually literally at the office as we speak, which actually sometimes is even more complicated, frankly, is that we have to be able to sort of walk and chew gum at the same time, because if you want to do the painting and you want to go for the hike and you want to do this kind of meaningful work, you're probably finding that you have to work 40 hours a week at the same time. You know, you want to get on retreat. But what happens is we surrender and we cave to the survival aspect and say, well, I can't do anything because I just work too much. And then our job sort of becomes everything and we kind of bail. We feel as though we have to. And it says this is really, really hard to do this, to do both at the same time, which is usually what we find. I've always found that I've had to do it. Like, yes, I like to take my kids for a hike and I like to do things with my children and I like to do art projects outside and I like to play music. And I also have to check my, I have to work and survive at the same time. And I have to have this kind of work-life balance thing that everybody in our culture, let's be honest, is mostly terrible at. You know, and also in the workplace, in the corporate workplace that many of us are familiar with, you get rewarded for abandoning your work. We get rewarded for this kind of thing. So when we think about, when I think about my Dharma practice, I think about my Dharma practice literally as this path factor of right action. To me, that's what right action is. Right work, right endeavor. Everything I'm saying about it goes in that path factor. It's not just about the five precepts. That's not broad enough for me. You know, I do recovery work. I do therapy work. I do lots of different work on myself. In fact, to be honest with you, most of the work that I do, I don't get paid for. And I don't suspect that I ever will. In fact, most of the work that I do on myself, I pay for. I pay to go on the retreat. I give Donna and support to my teachers. I pay my therapists. You know, I a lot of the work that I do, not only do I not get paid for it, I actually have to pay for it. But if I want to flourish and I want to make meaning and have the life that I want to have for myself, I have to be willing to make those sacrifices and be willing how to, it's like a puzzle, isn't it? It's like to me, this whole Dharma Eightfold Path is like a really weird puzzle. Where I'm like, how am I supposed to fit all these pieces in? There's too many pieces. They ever feel like that? Like there's way too many pieces to this puzzle. And so we have to stay in that process of, and it's a sila thing. This is sila. This is about our sense of integrity. And we have to also, in that, ultimately in that, we have to have integrity with our own selves. We have to not abandon the painting project or the piece of art or the hike or the walk or the whatever it is. I'm sure everybody has one or two of these things that I'm talking about. And I think it's really important, and it's been very important to me, to see these as a part of my Dharma practice. Right, part of the way that I acclimate towards Dharma work, that I kind of take this on, I find it to be, it actually keeps me more engaged, you know? And so as somebody who sort of does both, like, you know, my Dharma work also, you know, this is what I do for a living. And it's, you know, most of what I do in my, most of what I do to survive, you know, I don't particularly enjoy. I do tons and tons of emails. I'm always scheduling and canceling events. People are agreeing to do something and then not following through. Like most of it being a Dharma teacher, the amount of administrative, like I don't have a tech support company. So when my website crashes, I got to log into WordPress and figure out how to get the thing back. And how come my PayPal link won't link up to my bank? And so I spend probably 10 or 15 hours a week doing stuff I'm not interested in doing at all. I just have to. Right. And I'm like, I didn't be a Dharma teacher so I could learn how to use WordPress or build these online classes. I've just gotten good at a lot of things. It sort of makes me laugh. But I think a lot of times that's how it is, isn't it? And when we start to compartmentalize these things, this is when it gets problems. And also when we think about like the teachings on self, one of the big problems in this conversation here is mostly we think that we are our jobs. We think that what we do to survive defines us, right? You know, if you meet, you know, if you're a mechanic and you meet somebody at a barbecue or your friends, you know, some kind of family event, social event, and someone says, what do you do? You usually say, well, I'm a mechanic. You don't say, well, you know, I like to play guitar and I like, you know, maybe we get to that. Or we say, well, I'm in recovery, or, you know, I'm working on some, you know, some stuff that happened in my early life. And we know we usually just kind of, we are our jobs. Right. And in a very limited way. And so when we start to think of these path factors traditionally as, okay, actions is just sort of how I behave in the world and livelihood is what I do for my work, I think we're missing out on a lot. I think having a broader perspective is really, really key here, and getting a sense of like, and I think it's good for all of us. It's been helpful for me to recognize, well, what is my work? You know, my work as a father, my work as a teacher, my work as a mentor, my work as a husband, my work as a son, my work as coming to terms with having spent almost 50 decades in this Dave Smith experience. Seems like there's a lot of work that's not done here yet. And taking all that on, I was like, okay, this is my Dharma practice. This is my work. And I want to get a good sense of what that is. And then, well, to support that work, I need to survive, which means I need to get money. And I don't know if you've noticed, but usually, you know, if you want to get money, you probably have to do something you don't really want to do. That's sort of why they pay you, right? They're like, here, we got this thing that needs to get done. Nobody else wants to do it. You can come and do it. We'll give you some money, you know, we'll give you some money for it. That's kind of a work. That's kind of our culture. It's like, you know, the more fun it is, the less it pays, you know? You know, it's just like the more annoying and difficult and challenging it is, the more you get. It's like, here's this thing that needs to get done that nobody knows how to do. If you can figure it out, we'll give you a ton of money for it, you know, and we'll work you. And our culture overworks and underpays, and I don't need to go down that road, but y'all know what I mean. There was a story on NPR about 6 months ago that I really liked, and that story was called The 25th Hour. And it was a story about corporate America. It was really a story about like stockbrokers and people in banking and the financial world, which is, I guess, a total nightmare. I don't know anything about that world. But, you know, and the story was about like how all these people were leaving their Goldman Sachs jobs. And basically people in their late 20s and mid 30s are leaving these $250,000, $300,000 a year careers because they're just like, it's not even worth it. Like the money's not worth it. Like, and part of the story was the Goldman Sachs and the kind of financial institutes, one of their mechanisms is, how do we get the 25th hour out of you? How do we get people to work that 25th hour when in reality you are supposed to be working 8? How'd they get you from 8 to 16? And how the hell did they get you from 16 to 24? Now they want the 25th hour? And that was kind of the moral of the story, was like the overwhelm of that. If people are just like, they're like, dude, I've given you, I actually don't even have a 25th hour, so you can't have it, so I'm going to quit. And this is why I think a lot of people are leaving the workplace, which I think is really great, and I applaud that. Is there that, you know? I largely blame the digital world, you know, like I work for myself. So it's like, I'm totally guilty of putting the kids to bed. And instead of meditating or reading a book, I come upstairs and I bang out 3 or 4 emails that I didn't get to that day. And that, like, how many of you take a work call or a work email after work hours, right? All of you, right? Like, when are you not at work? Like, employers expect us to respond to that email at 10:30 at night, you know? I mean, the unions and the factory workers back in the, you know, the 40s and the 50s, they worked really, really hard to get people to clock out at 5 o'clock and, you know, work your 8 hours and clock out and then go home. Like, people don't clock out anymore. You know, you're expected to work around the clock. And if you find yourself on the receiving end of this, put this in a kind of an ethical dilemma of like, well, this isn't right. This isn't okay. And then we're forced to have some kind of uprising or some kind of standing up for ourselves, which I know many people have done. But, you know, the non-monastic Dharma path is a really hard path. And if we don't have this broader perspective on it, and we think our Dharma practice is this thing that we do 30 minutes in the morning or in the evening on a cushion in the side of our house, and maybe we get to a weekend retreat or one retreat a year, man, you're missing out on so much. So I'll talk more about the integration of these next week, but I want to pause there and leave some time. I'm sure you have, and I'm hoping you have some questions or some reflections on this. So I'd be happy to hear your thoughts on this evening. And as always, thank you for your kind attention.